Hello, and thank you all for joining the call today. Chaco Cultural Natural Historic Park is next on the chopping block to further Washington's decision to tilt the scales of balance in regards to multiple use on public lands. In an attempt to undermine the potential decision of the BLM to grant permits to the oil and gas industry, several professors and archaeologists and rangers have joined forces to produce a report celebrating the efforts to research, preserve, and protect the greater Chaco landscape. The report was released today. On the call, we have Paul F. Reed, preservation archaeologist and Chaco scholar from Archaeology Southwest, G.B. Cornucopia, interpretive ranger from the Chaco Cultural National Historic Park, Anna Sofair, president and founder of the Solstice Project, which is a research group on Chaco studies, Carrie Heitman, Ph.D., assistant professor of anthropology from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and Ruth M. Van Dyke, Ph.D., professor of anthropology from Binghamton University. Now, I'll turn it over to Paul F. Reed to begin.
Good morning. I'd like to welcome all the members of the press to our call. I want to introduce our topic this morning and then speak really briefly about how all this came about and why we're all on the call this morning. So I represent Archaeology Southwest, which is a Tucson-based nonprofit organization. We jumped into this issue in 2014 in response to what we considered alarming developments in the Farmington, New Mexico BLM office, in the lands managed by that office. At that time, more than 100 wells had been drilled into the Mancos and Gallup Shale, which is a geologic formation, to extract primarily oil and some gas through the process of hydraulic fracturing or fracking. Now, BLM had permitted these wells under the authority of their 2003 management plan, which unfortunately did not anticipate such developments. So BLM, in the course of this development happening, and this began probably in late 2011 and really took off in 2012, BLM decided to amend their 2003 plan, and they asked for input from the affected communities, people on the ground out there, and a large, broad range of interested parties in the environmental and cultural fields. So Archaeology Southwest has been involved in this effort then for the last four calendar years. We've worked primarily with BLM, but also with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, who joined the planning effort last fall in 2016. Our primary partners in this effort has included the Wilderness Society, the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and the National Parks and Conservation Association. We've worked with a variety of other groups as well. One of the more important outreach efforts we've made over the last couple of years is working with the All Pueblo Council of Governors and the Navajo Nation to ensure that Native voices have a strong representation in this process. Finally, over the last several years, we've been in close touch with the New Mexico delegation, including Senators Tom Udall and Heinrich and Congressman Ben Ray Lujan. Now, the archaeologists and researchers on this call this morning represent really just a sampling of the folks who are doing independent and collaborative research across the greater Chaco landscape. There are many other people and institutions who have concerns for the research in Chaco Canyon and across the landscape and preservation of the greater Chaco landscape. And I feel, as a member of this group, that I'm fortunate to be here along with the others to try and convey these concerns. In particular, our Native American colleagues and friends have grave concerns about oil and gas development in this area. Now, the group is united by its fundamental interest in understanding how the ancient Chacoans in their world functioned on their landscape, what was important to them, and in conjunction with our research concerns, we have a high level of concern over the threat of these recent oil and gas developments and the fracking in the Mancos Shale. We believe that the threat is heightened by several recent executive and secretarial orders that have come out from the current administration that aim to prioritize energy development on public lands, and we feel strongly that this will only further fragment and degrade the greater Chaco landscape. Now, Chaco Canyon itself is a national park, and it is a UNESCO World Heritage Site that preserves the history and culture of the Pueblo people. Chaco Canyon is the ancestral home of Puebloan peoples and is where many of the cultural traditions that are practiced to this day at pueblos such as Acoma, Zuni, Hopi, Tasuque, Taos, Zia, and the other pueblos. It's where these traditions emerged. Chaco's magnificent houses, including Pueblo Bonito, Chichel Kettle, and the others, still tower over the canyon floor, while in the surrounding landscape, ancient roads and pathways to outlying villages and shrines offer silent testimony to the wonders of the ancient Chacoan society. Over more recent centuries, the landscape around Chaco was settled by Navajo people and other groups who have added their own unique traditions to the rich cultural heritage. Now, the greater Chacoan landscape includes Chaco Culture National Historic Park and many cultural resources in the surrounding area that are affiliated with ancient Chaco, including the Great North Road and the Pierre site. Over the years, BLM has leased more than 90% of its managed landscape for oil and gas development. Together with our partners, we have asked the BLM and the BIA to put a moratorium on future oil and gas development in a 10-mile protection zone that extends all the way around Chaco Park. We also want to ensure the protection of significant sites beyond that 10-mile zone in the broader landscape. This includes, in particular, the Pierre site, which Ruth Van Dyke will tell us about in greater detail. I understand that the All Pueblo Governors Council is currently considering a resolution calling for a permanent moratorium on oil and gas development in this 10-mile zone and extending up the North Road. Now, Archaeology Southwest has been in intensive dialogue with BLM and BIA as they finalize the amendment to this 2003 plan and develop a new environmental impact statement for the landscape. We feel strongly at Archaeology Southwest that the standard approach to cultural resource protection, which is described in Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act, is not working in this highly sensitive area. This approach basically calls for cultural resources, that is, historic and archaeological sites, traditional cultural places, sacred sites, to be identified and then avoided by construction activities, or to in some way have the impacts to these resources mitigated. We believe that the agencies managing this large piece of landscape should protect more of the landscape, particularly those areas surrounding Chaco and Great House communities. With the advances in various technologies that we're going to hear from our other participants on this call about, it is abundantly clear that archaeologists who are going out to do work prior to oil and gas development are not identifying all of the sensitive archaeological resources and phenomena that exist on this landscape, and that if we continue with this current approach to resource protection, we're going to have significant loss of additional undocumented cultural resources and just expanded impacts to this overall landscape. Finally, then, we ask the agencies to work with the many stakeholders as they're amending their plan and developing this new EIS to find a way to protect what remains of the ancient, fragile Chacoan landscape. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Next up, we have Mr. G.B. Cornucopia.
Hello, I'm here in Chaco, and I always feel that my part in all of this is to champion the visitor's experience of Chaco, which I've seen change in my 30 years here for a variety of reasons, one of which is the light pollution that is encroaching on the park. Since 1998, we've had a working observatory here in the park that's for amateur astronomers, for people who'd like to do research, but it's also here for the visiting public. And one of the hardest things to convey to the visiting public when they come for just a day is what was this place actually like 1,000 years ago? Today, there are cars that drive through it on our loop drive, and people come and they see other visitors. But when you're in the park at night, on a clear night, then the full experience of Chaco becomes much more clear in terms of the visuals and what you're seeing in the sky. The sky has changed hardly at all in the 1,000 years since the Chacoans were here. Many of their buildings and many other places and features in the canyon are aligned to certain celestial happenings, like the summer solstice, winter solstice, and the equinoxes. This morning, we went out to see an alignment that occurs at one of the buildings here on the equinox, and we had about 100 people. who came to see that. Our Night Sky programs that we do three nights a week actually are the most popular of our interpretive programs. And it's important when people to come, when they come to see these things, to understand that when they look into the sky, they are looking at a direct link as to what the ancient people saw in terms of the sky itself and its orientation and the constellations, but also how dark it is. In 2013, we were designated an International Dark Sky Park, and it's important by the International Dark Sky Association, which is over in Arizona. And in order to be designated such, obviously you have to have a dark sky, but more importantly, it has to become a part of the experience of the place. So we make use of the dark sky. We protect what we call the cultural resource and the natural resource. The cultural resource, of course, are the archaeological features, the buildings and other things that we find here, the petroglyphs, the pictographs, the ground cover that often shows potsherds, other artifacts that come out. But when you look into the night sky, you are seeing the same world they saw 1,000 years ago. And it's such an opportunity for people to understand our relationship with the larger cosmos when you're standing in a place where people made use of that picture and actually built buildings embedding some of their knowledge of the sky in those in that architecture. And it gives us a sense of the true relationship that all humans have had with the natural world. Most people who've lived upon this planet have taken it for granted that when the sun goes down and if it's clear and there's no moon, you can see forever. And the people here took that for granted, and it's not something we can take for granted much anymore. If you have seen those famous pictures from space that show all the lights, especially in the developed countries, especially in the United States, you get a sense of how we are insulating ourselves from the night sky and other aspects also of the natural world. As you increase lighting anywhere, you're going to change the animals, you're going to change the plants, and certainly people. So to understand Chaco more than just intellectually, it really takes being here, standing in the midst, as close as we can get to the experience that the people had 1,000 years ago. And as a place that protects the sky, because we consider it both a natural but also a cultural aspect of the canyon. It is a cultural feature here, and we want to protect that. Last night, driving into the canyon late at night from the north side, as soon as I turned off the main road, there were two flares going on not too far away where I could see them. I took pictures of them. And as I drove further in, getting closer to Chaco, I saw three other flares. This changes one's experience of the topography, of the landscape. And we think it's worthwhile trying to maintain as much of the original experience that people might have had here 1,000 years ago. Understanding Chaco intellectually is important. Understanding it from an archaeological point of view, trying to understand the social organizational changes that occurred here that astound us still, the great buildings, the monumental structures, but standing on the landscape and being able to see it in the same way as the ancient people would have seen it, would have felt it, is, I think, a very important aspect. And there are fewer and fewer and fewer places, especially in the United States, where the dark sky is even visible. It has been said as of about 2 years ago that most people on the planet live where they cannot see the Milky Way. One should not live in a world where they cannot see the Milky Way. Having a place like Chaco, I think, is very important to connect us to the ancient people that have lived upon the planet, but also, importantly, to connect us today to the natural world. Thank you.
Thank you, GB. GB is currently in Chaco and has to pop off. If anyone has any questions for him, they can be directed to me offline, and we would be happy to connect you.
Excellent.
Next up, we have Anna Sofair with the Solstice Project.
Hello? Are you hearing me? Hello? Not sure you're hearing me. Could you connect back to me?
Anna, you're live. Go on. You're fine.
Oh, okay. Great. So picking up on what GB described, that was just marvelous, so that we got a sense of what the experience today is still like in Chaco, that you have the potential anyway to get some relationship with the people there 1,000 years ago. And I think it also made me yet again aware that why Chaco is there originally with all that development is in part because the skies are so spectacular, the horizons are so vast, and it gave them the opportunity to celebrate the events of the sky, the cycles of the sun and the moon, and to do it on such an incredible scale. They did it intimately with the Sun Dagger site, with Shadow and Light, where they had a dagger of light through a beautiful spiral on the top of a butte to mark summer solstice, and then went on with other markings for the winter solstice, the equinox, and the lunar extremes. Well, all of that would not have happened just anywhere, but it had to happen in that sense of an incredible center place in the whole of the San Juan Basin. And the same is true of aligning the buildings, the great long walls of the buildings with their multi-storied construction and hundreds of rooms. The effort was made to plan that along this same celestial pattern. But it only would be in that place. And we're lucky that in the last 100 years or so, we've been able to understand the complexity of that place to some extent. But what's come up, I think, for me, especially in the last several years, is the awareness of the enormous expanse of Chaco's expression throughout the San Juan Basin, but beyond. So you find sites 120 miles from the center that look very much like the central buildings. And what's the emblematic look of those sites are not just individual buildings, but integration with road construction. And there could be 4 or 5, sometimes more roads from some of these sites, 3 or 4. And earthwork construction that funnel the roads into the buildings. It's that level of planning, regional planning, replication of these sites that makes Chaco stand out even more than we thought 10 years ago. So what do we need to do today to protect the larger region? I think we have to think beyond jurisdictions, because what's happened is Chaco's been cut up into pieces by the governmental agencies and private interests as well. And if we can use the opportunity of the new technologies, which we showed worked so well, especially LIDAR that we used on the Great North Road, we have a chance to show this enormous expanse, to document it ahead of any activity that would be destructive to it. And here's the key. We've traditionally held some rules and regulations for protection of sites, but they're isolated to sites. And what's not considered adequately is how those sites extend to the landscape. And that's where the new technology can help us. And it's sort of a modification of the rules and regulations and the planning by the agencies, so that you look at the whole complex of each site, and that an individual site can, for example, go in 35 miles with the North Road to connect to Coots Canyon out of Chaco Canyon. That tells us that nothing is individualized in the Chaco world. We take Pueblo Bonito, how many roads come out of it and connect to other sites? Typically, roads will connect to great kivas. It might be hundreds of years earlier, as at Kenya'a. So you have time bridges of our ancestral people relating to their ancestral people. But you also have these enormous topographic relationships. The South Road out of Chaco goes 35 miles to Hasta Butte, the largest topographic feature to the south. So just seeing that the San Juan Basin is connected north and south into the center with these linear features has taught us a lot. And opens the door to understanding Chaco on a landscape scale. At the same time that the interests in the minerals there are so great. And what I think is happening, and has happened for years, is that people who don't understand Chaco and are totally new to it are seeing that area as sort of a wasteland. What value has it in the modern world or the ancient world to them? It has the value of all these minerals, oil, gas, coal, uranium. And we have to, I think it's our obligation, as people who've been working with Chaco for decades, to bring out to the public and to the people who affect policy the great value of going back and connecting, as GB said, with the people who were so connected with their natural world. And it is still a unique opportunity to do that with Chaco. So thank you.
Thank you, Anna. Next up, we have Carrie Heitman, PhD, Assistant Professor of Anthropology from University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Carrie?
Hi, good morning. Thank you all for your interest in this important issue and for taking the time to be on the call. And I also just want to start by thanking my esteemed colleagues on the line, Ruth Van Dyke, Paul Reed, Anna Sofer, and GB Cornucopia, for their ongoing work, as you're hearing about, and tireless advocacy on behalf of the greater Chaco landscape, a place that we all hold in great, very great esteem. So my name is Carrie Heitman, as I was introduced. In addition to being an assistant professor of anthropology here at UNL, I'm also a faculty fellow at the Center for Digital Research in the Humanities, which will become relevant here in my remarks in a moment. And I'm also the director of the Chaco Research Archive, an online repository of digitized information on Chaco Canyon. The work and observations I'll be speaking about here today, and I'll say my remarks, I'm going to keep relatively brief, come from various collaborative projects, including collaborations with my former graduate student, Sean Field, who graduated in May. And if you have the press packet in your possession, he's listed as a co-author on our contribution to that packet. So the press packet includes our longer form narrative, and for the purposes of this call, I'm going to distill that broader discussion, which was distilled already from an even broader discussion. I'm going to distill that down to three main points. Point one, in the year 2017, land management decisions, like those made by the BLM, depend upon diverse digital data systems. These systems have known weaknesses in terms of missing data, incomplete data, and incorrect data. And these weaknesses, left unacknowledged, have real-world consequences with regard to vulnerable cultural resources. In the press packet, I provide more background on these consequences and provide two recent examples for your reference. Point two, data segregation has hampered our collective ability to manage and preserve the greater Chaco landscape. Information about Chaco landscape features exist in separate, unaggregated data sets, which are maintained by state and federal agencies, tribes, and separate scholarly networks. And I'll just add, making reference to something Anna just mentioned a moment ago, that we're also here dealing with all these various jurisdictions that she described for you. In acknowledgement of this, we must do more to erode this balkanized system and promote and support responsible data sharing and the timely dissemination of research findings. Point three, we have evidence that a previously visible Chaco road feature has now disappeared. This is described in the press packet, where we point out that the speed of this feature degradation between 1983 and 2017, between those years, This is described in the press packet where we point out that the speed of this feature degradation between 1983 and 2017 and the speed of that degradation should urge further action to protect these fragile cultural landscape features from further destruction. And in closing, I'd like to note that technologies like those that Anna's already mentioned and some others, things like LIDAR, GIS, and various forms of satellite imagery are vastly expanding our ability to document and interpret cultural resources, which is why things like space archaeology have been very much in the news in the last few years. It's a tremendously exciting moment in archaeology, and many of us, including at least three of us on this line, have seen the promise of these technologies when applied to the greater Chaco landscape. However, our ability to identify cultural resources using advanced sensing technologies will not in and of itself protect these places from possible obliteration. To do that, we must first apply these technologies more broadly and continuously across the greater Chaco landscape. This is something we have not yet had the opportunity to do, and various people so far in their remarks this morning have made reference to that. And secondly, we must work closely with the BLM to make sure that the information we do have is incorporated into their resource management plan amendment as described by Paul Reed, and ultimately, we hope, into a very thoughtful master leasing plan. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Carrie. And last but certainly not least is Ruth M. Van Dyke, PhD Professor of Anthropology at Binghamton University. Ruth?
Good morning, and I want to second my colleagues. Thanks to the press for being interested in the issue and joining us this morning. And I certainly want to second the great appreciation I have for all of the hard work that not only the folks on this line, but many other Chaco and Native American colleagues are involved with in terms of the greater Chaco landscape. To situate my remarks a little bit, I'll just say that the human experience of being inside Chaco Canyon, of moving among the great houses in Chaco Canyon, of understanding Chaco Canyon from kind of a sensory, physical, human dimension or perspective is something, this is something that's long interested me. You know, as an anthropologist, I want to know what made Chaco tick, what were people doing there. And in 2007, I wrote a book actually called The Chaco Experience, in which I argued that one of the things that was happening in Chaco was that certain important people were actually orchestrating an experience that was had by visitors who lived in the greater Chaco landscape, in these outliers that we've been hearing about. And when these visitors would come to Chaco Canyon, perhaps for events like solstices or equinoxes, they would potentially walk on certain routes. They would see certain things. They would not see other things. They would hear certain things, not hear other things, perhaps. The monumental architecture there is arranged so that it facilitates an overall sensory impact on a visitor, and you really get a feeling that, yes, Chaco is the center place. Chaco is the appropriate balancing point for the universe, and I think, and I argued in this book, that that's something that the leaders of Chaco at that time were very cognizant of, and certainly you could hear in the comments made by my colleagues, particularly GB and Anna, that this is still very much the case. It's important to us today as members of the public, it's important to our Native colleagues, and it's important to us as archaeologists and scholars to try to understand Chaco intellectually. So obviously things like viewscapes and soundscapes are a really integral part of this kind of sensory understanding, but they're not something that is well protected by existing law, nor are they something that is easily studied archaeologically. And we're really just kind of at the cusp, both in terms of our technology and in terms of our theory, of thinking about how to study such things as long-distance viewscapes or soundscapes across the Chacoan world or across the Chacoan landscapes. Across the Chaco landscape. Now, as you heard Paul talk about earlier, our CRM laws will protect specific archaeological sites, and in fact, they do a reasonably good job of that. But when you're talking about something like a viewscape, the CRM laws do not, in fact, allow us to say, hey, you know, the line of sight between this particular Chacoan outlier and that particular mountain peak is something important, and we don't want to block it. We have no laws that really allow us to specifically protect that, or certainly the way the existing laws are being deployed right now, they're not being deployed in a way that would actually protect that. So to that end, I'll talk a little bit more specifically about a Chaco and outlier called Pierre's, which is a pretty important one. And there are, by the way, over 100 of these. It depends on how you count, but Pierre's is a pretty important one. That's located about 15 miles north of Chaco on the Great North Road out of Chaco. And so important, in fact, that it was included as part of the UNESCO World Heritage Designation in 1987 when that designation was granted to the national park that encompasses Chaco Canyon itself. Pierre's consists of two great houses, which are similar to the great houses in Chaco Canyon, but much smaller. And they're on top of a small mesa or a butte, and they look up and down the Great North Road. And there are also some very interesting kind of badlands fires in the community, one of which has evidence of a lot of burning on top of it. And the archaeologist who recorded it originally dubbed it El Faro, or the lighthouse. And the North Road goes right through the community. There's also a small surrounding community of habitation sites. So it seems pretty clear that this landscape is all about seeing back and forth to Chaco and seeing back and forth across the Great North Road. You can imagine things like people in the past having processions up the North Road and actually processing into this community, perhaps up to the Great Houses or past the Great Houses. So I think that the Pierre's community is particularly relevant when you try to understand Chaco intellectually and perhaps sensorily from this experiential perspective. So viewscapes and soundscapes are important there. Well, the Bureau of Land Management did a great job of following the letter of the law when all of the oil and gas drilling was permitted in this region. So they didn't actually impact any great houses. They didn't actually bulldoze away any archaeological sites. But what they did, quite legally, was they placed 12 pump jacks, oil drilling pump jacks, in view of the great houses. And some of these are actually right up on the horizon, and some of them flash in the sunlight. The nearest one is less than a mile from the Pierre's Great Houses, and as of last November, it was actually audible from the Great Houses. So this is a pretty significant impact, and it definitely abrogates our ability to think about that landscape in Chaco in terms, and it also, quite frankly, lends the Pierre's community the aspect of an industrial park. So, and this is, again, following the letter of the law. So this is to underscore, I offer this case study to underscore Paul's point that what we really need to do is, first of all, as archaeologists, we need to be cognizant of these less tangible aspects of the landscape, like viewscapes and soundscapes, and figure out good ways to study them, record them, provide the information, as Carrie was suggesting or arguing, that land managers can access to know that these things are important and that they exist and they're real. But secondly, we really need to set aside large landscape level areas to protect and to prohibit drilling altogether. The BLM actually has followed procedures to mitigate the impacts, they say, of these different rigs, and yet, you know, they're there and they're quite visible, and at times they are loud. So I very much support the notion that we hold the BLM to protecting at least a 10-mile buffer around Chaco Canyon and certain other areas along the Great North Road, and prohibit drilling entirely or prohibit new leases in those areas, and do the best we can to move forward to prevent the situation arising where other outliers are turned into a situation like Pierre's. There's other outliers out there that are still relatively pristine. There are many that are being just partially impacted, and we need to take care to study the soundscapes and the view sheds and protect those from these kinds of oil and gas impacts, which frankly would not be that difficult to do if we simply had the legal structure and the will to do so. So that's all I have to say, and thanks very much for listening.
Thanks, Ruth. Again, I want to say thank you to all of our speakers. And at this time, if anyone has a question for one of our speakers, please press *3 to be entered into the queue. Again, that's *3 if you have a question. All right. Well, again, thanks for joining this call. Oh, it looks like we have one question, actually. Hold on.
Our first question is going to come from Frank Clifford. Frank, you are live.
Well, I've been gone for a couple of months, and I wanted to ask what, if anything, has occurred to prompt this press conference.
Well, this is Paul. I'll address this briefly and certainly open it up for the other participants. We feel that there is an increasing number of executive orders and secretarial orders coming out of this administration that are continuing to alarm us. Just yesterday, we got the release of an environmental assessment or an EA on lands to be leased right on the edge of the 10-mile zone we've talked about. In fact, there were several parcels that were plotted at something like 9.8 miles. So within that 10-mile zone, a little bit confusing because later in that same document, it indicates that they're actually withdrawing the ones, the parcels that were within the 10-mile zone. But, you know, without getting in too specific on this, basically we're seeing a ramping up of oil and gas activity under the Trump administration, and we're concerned that what we've been working towards with BLM and BIA on the greater Chaco landscape, a lot of our recommendations and the like may get swept away. The other thing we recently learned is that BLM will release alternatives. These are the main things being considered for the amendment to their resource management plan sometime next month. They had originally said these were going to come out in June, and then it was July. So we've had a little bit of delay there. And then we've gotten word sort of off the record from the BLM that they have totally had to rework their alternatives based on input from D.C., from Washington, D.C. So this concerns us greatly because we feel that the folks in the local Farmington office and their partners at BIA and Gallup probably have the best information for, you know, sorting out alternatives for this plan. And if they're getting direction from Washington, D.C., we have no idea what that direction is as yet. But that's essentially the nature of the threat that we feel, the new threats that we're faced right now.
What about the status of the master leasing plan that you were hoping to find acceptance for?
Well, all we've heard from BLM on the master leasing plan is that it is still something they have, you know, they're considering as a potential in their alternatives. But since they haven't released the alternatives, we don't know. Once they do that next month, if they hold to that schedule, then we'll be able to see if they've pulled components of the master leasing plan, if they've pulled it as an entirety and said this is an alternative, or if they've totally disregarded it. And, you know, again, we have no indication at this point how they're heading.
Okay. If nobody else has any questions, I'll ask another one, but I'll wait my – no, wait.
Frank, you're actually okay to ask another question.
Okay. I'm curious about the road that seems to have disappeared and what it connected and how you knew about it in the first place. It would have been long before LIDAR was in existence, I guess, if 1983 was when it was first observed. What happened?
Hi, I'll take that one since I mentioned it. There's some more specifics in the press packet if you've gotten a hold of that. If not, I'm sure somebody higher up the food chain than me will get that to you. But these are roads that were identified both in terms of being on the ground physically by archaeologists as well as through historic aerial photography, which we have going back to the 1930s. And so these are roads that are visible, and there's a figure that's in the press packet that shows this earlier visible road, and that, you know, today, and I should note that, you know, this is using aerial photography, it's not using LIDAR, but it is a case where we can quite dramatically see Here's a road that was visible, and now using the same kind of aerial photography, we can't see it. That's not to say that we couldn't go back with LIDAR and see that same road alignment using those technologies, but it does speak to the speed at which we are losing these features. And one of the other things that we point out is that within the boundaries of, so this is a road, sorry, going back to the first part of your question, this is a road that's going from a Chacoan outlier called Pueblo Pintado into the canyon, and so we could call it the Pueblo Pintado Road. And some of my other colleagues, you know, if they want to add more about that, but yeah, so this is a road from Pintado into the canyon that was visible previously using just aerial photography. But it points to the fact that we can use various kinds of technologies and also legacy data, so historic information we have about these cultural resources to document the rate at which we're losing them, the context in which we're losing them, to help guide the kinds of processes all of us have talked about here to be able to manage this landscape responsibly and to preserve as much as we can of what's left.
Is there anything in the law that can be argued protects large landscapes?
This is Paul Reed. Frank, I think that with the National Historic Preservation Act, which and Section 106 of that, which is the main legislative, you know, initiative that keeps us going out and checking prior to development, that there is really no provision there to protect larger pieces of landscape directly. We have certain considerations under that law to talk about how sites are associated to each other. You know, the feeling one gets, this is actually one of the terms used, the feeling one gets at an archaeological site. But the real piece of legislation that could help this is the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, of 1970. NEPA talks about protecting larger pieces of the landscape, depending upon the considerations that are taken, you know, that people are considering. So we might have an angle under NEPA. The problem is when it comes to cultural resources, the managers rely on Section 106 and don't really use NEPA specifically to try to protect larger pieces of the landscape. We've sort of evolved to this, identify individual archaeological sites, you know, put circles of avoidance around them, and then let the development happen in and around all these different features. You know, and as several of us have discussed on the call, this has resulted in incredible fragmentation of the ancient landscape. Certainly things we can't reverse, but what we're all trying to talk about here is identifying some areas that could be set aside and at least studied before development occurs so that we know what we're actually seeing destroyed through this development.
Could I perhaps
add a bit to what we've been talking about, because I think we haven't maybe clarified a bit about the confusing word roads. Roads most people think of as for trade and transportation or some utilitarian use. We've used that word, but increasingly hearing from Pueblo people, especially about the Great North Road and about other roads from Hopi, from Acoma people, these roads are really, at least some of them, carrying spiritual significance. And so they extend out of the great houses that are looking more and more in our analysis to have ceremonial and ritual aspects as ritual avenues or spiritual avenues. And if people don't understand this who are making public policy, they really are countering the legacy that's today alive of the ancestral people of the Pueblo and the Navajo people who feel strongly about these roads as spiritual also. And I'm not sure that was, it's hard to convey. Pueblo people don't speak outright about this, but they did say about the North Road that it was connecting with the extremely important direction of North as place of origin and return of the spirits. So I just thought to add that. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Let me ask one last question then, if nobody else is doing that. And that is, someone made the point that there seems to have been incomplete or inaccurate data in the decision-making process over protection of certain sites. I'd like to know a little bit more about what that was a reference to.
Of particular sites. Well, I think actually that Ruth did a very good description of how Pierre's has got a primary ritual architecture that's related to the Great North Road. And as I just mentioned, that road has incredibly important significance to Pueblo and people as connecting to their most important direction, the north. So that's one example. But I think we're seeing it now surrounding the canyon and coming close to areas like Pintado, possibly, up in the La Plata region, where there are marvelous circle roads. That's also primary for BLM development. So there are sites that are getting, without understanding of their extended leasing. And I think Paul's documented that quite well, how much that's increased and surrounded these areas.
Well,
and now that's only from the park. Sorry, go ahead.
I think you, I'm actually going to kind of prompt Carrie. Maybe Carrie, you're about to answer that. But I think that what you might be referring to, Frank, is the fact that we have these databases that are incomplete and inaccessible and don't talk to each other. And so when the BLM goes to say, well, are there any sites in this area, they pull up a database called NIMCRIS, which is housed in Santa Fe, and the sites that archaeologists already know about may or may not be in there. So I don't know. Carrie, take it away.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to just very briefly reference, and thanks for asking the question, Frank, if I may. So right, exactly, is it just riffing off of what Ruth clarified, right? So we have a situation where, you know, the BLM has their own information architecture in which they're bringing in data into their GIS to help guide these decisions, as you would expect in the year 2017, that people are using geographic information systems to drive these decisions, to make these decisions and allocate parcels and so forth and boundaries. But right, they're depending on things like NIMCRIS, and over the last few years, work that Ruth and I and many other people have done, we have recognized that they were often dealing with, they had information on Chaco and outliers. It was sometimes, you know, the locations were completely wrong, and other scholars knew that because we'd gone off individually or collectively and re-recorded these sites or updated the UTM locations for these sites within our own geographic information systems. And so we worked very hard together collaboratively, a whole team of people, including folks at the University of Arizona, folks at Binghamton, here at UNL, and one of Anna's colleagues and collaborators, Richard Friedman, to try to reconcile these information sources so that we could give that information then back to the BLM. But it's really just this was just about Great House locations themselves. And as people have been talking about, there's many more resources out there that are either undocumented or incompletely documented. And so, you know, while we don't fault the BLM for relying on this state database, which is the authoritative one that exists, the NIMCRIS one that Ruth mentioned, it is also the case that it is a very imperfect system, as these systems are. And, you know, we all have a collective responsibility to work differently, but we're also constrained by these what we called in a recent presentation, this tyranny of these digital data ecosystems, and we were also just subject to them. And so we have to find ways to try to get better information into the hands of people that are building these GIS databases, and that, you know, is the foundation from which they're making these land management decisions. So we know that there are these problems. We know there's misinformation, and I think we need to take that into account. We, including the BLM, need to take that the weaknesses in our fundamental data into account moving forward.
Well, and this is Ruth again. If I could just add one thing, it's also the case that things like viewscapes and soundscapes were not necessarily of
concern or were not paramount in archaeologists' thinking when they designed the existing site recording forms. And these recording forms have been updated and redesigned many times over the course of their life. But I think the current NIMCRIS recording form has 12 pages, and nowhere in there does it ever prompt you to think about or talk about viewscapes or soundscapes. So that's an issue for, you know, archaeologists in the state of New Mexico, and perhaps nationally, to be thinking about. Is it time to update our site recording so that we prompt archaeological technicians who are in the field, often at sometimes at the behest of oil and gas companies, to see what's out there, to think about these particular issues and make sure that that information finds its way into a database in the first place?
Can you spell out the name of the database that you've been referring to? I'm just getting an acronym. What does it stand for?
It's the New Mexico Cultural Resource Inventory System, I think.
New Mexico Cultural Inventory.
New Mexico Cultural Resource Inventory. Or is it information or inventory system?
It's information.
Information.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, I'm not trying to like cast aspersions on those folks either at all. They are, I'm well aware, they're a state office that are severely understaffed and under budgeted. So, you know, it takes sort of a collective will to fix these things, and we can't just ask them to make changes.
Yeah, and I'll just second that. I mean, I do this for a living. I deal with these systems, and I understand in gory detail the challenges of this and of migrating systems over years and years and years. And right, they, you know, it's through no fault of any one person or one director or anyone at NIMCRIS. It's just the facts on the ground. It's just the reality. And as we refine these data, you know, sometimes it's scholars that are refining the data, but it's not necessarily part of our habit or workflow to then share that information back to NIMCRIS, and that's something else that we as academics and scholars need to change as well.
Agreed.
I wanted to ask where these press kits are available, whether they're online or how you're disseminating this information.
Frank, I can email you a copy directly, and then I can also point you to a couple websites where they can be found.
Okay, yeah, I would appreciate that, Paul. You have my email, right?
I do.
Okay. I'm very interested in knowing if, as you said, in October there will begin to be some publication of alternatives or some reaction to the master leasing plan. Like to be able to get a heads up on that.
Right. We're definitely watching for that.
Okay. Okay, I'm done. I appreciate you taking the time to answer my questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
We have time for one more question. If you have a question, please hit *3 to be put into the queue. There are no more questions. Please go ahead and contact Liz Trotter offline if you have any further follow-up questions to this call. Liz?
Oh, I'm so sorry. I was on mute. Thank you so much for joining us. You can reach out to me at trotter@smoothtwos.com, and I would be happy to provide you with any additional information, or if you'd like to speak out to or reach out to one of our speakers directly, I would be happy to connect you. We will be sending around a recording shortly. Thank you.